This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kate, I love when you go to a festival because I get to live vicariously.
And then you also get to talk to me when I am an exhausted shell of a human at the other end.
Before we get into Newcastle, this has been a really busy couple of weeks for you. You were doing a book pitching event with booksellers that involved Lee Sales. So we're going to start with that. Tell me everything.
Okay. So last week I flew up to Sydney to do this event, which was 10 Simon & Schuster authors at an evening event for booksellers, which, you know, they just haven't been able to do for ages and ages. And the idea was that it's like a speed pitching, speed dating kind of thing, so that the 10 authors with books coming out with Simon & Schuster would move around the tables of booksellers. And you had 5 minutes to introduce yourself, ask the booksellers to introduce themselves, and pitch the book. Now, let's be very clear that my book went to print like the ARC, and I finished the copy edits on the Friday, and this was the Wednesday. And I have not really had to talk about this book very much yet to anybody. I'm actually now, I really hope this happens live in our podcast, because I am now awaiting the printed copy of the ARC to arrive in my driveway, hopefully before the end of the day, because otherwise then it's Easter and I'm not going to get it till Tuesday. But so that was the concept. For me, delightful. You know me, I'm an extrovert. I can talk underwater.
But did you have a formal, because 5 minutes is tight. Like five minutes is almost harder for a talker in some ways.
5 minutes is super tight. What I had done, 5 minutes is super tight for any book, any normal book. The fact that mine has kind of four narratives, two additional narratives, and is set over kind of 300 years makes it also just a little trickier to talk to, and four main characters. So I was a little bit unsure about what to go in with. And what I decided was that because it was the day after my beautiful grandmother's, what would have been her 92nd birthday, I took her picture. So this was like my grounding thing. And the reason I took her picture is because the book's dedicated to grandma. I spent so much time talking to her about it, especially about the 1930 stuff. And also that the kind of bubbling idea around it, which is women's kind of made and found families and women workers and women living in households of women and sisters, and comes from my grandma's experience of growing up with her mum and her aunt and her sisters, because my great-grandfather was killed in a motorbike accident when she was really little. So she grew up in a house of women, and that's kind of partly what one of the threads through the book is. So I thought, if I take grandma with me and I start with that, I will work around it, you know, like rather than, it's not the hook, it's not the pitch necessarily, but at this early stage when I'm trying to work it out, that's what I'll start with. And what really worked about that is that it calmed me down. I had something physical, so I could also kind of deflect a little bit, because then people looked at the picture of grandma. And I didn't lose my train of thought, and I could also try different pitches. Like, I did really use it as an experiment, because there was, you know, you had people there like ranging from Booktopia to, you know, Dimmicks to big chains, Harry Harthog, Berkeley, Little Abbey's bookstore, you know, like really different range of booksellers and bookstores and audiences. And for some of them, I really leaned into the idea of the historical fiction. For some, I leaned into the contemporary Amazon workers egg freezing, you know, particularly when there was a bunch of young women who I was talking to, I leaned into that. So I kind of tested it. I tested the theory. And then at the end, especially when there was gorgeous people like Ben from Booktopia, who we know, I was like, okay, give me the lowdown. Like, how did that go? What worked? I could see from people's faces. Like at one point I went too hard on the abattoir research stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's good to know that some people are just going to blank me on that because they're like, I don't want to hear about you walking around in gumboots in an abattoir, lady. Like, that is not selling it for me.
That's so I think interesting.
Yeah.
That's,
and I actually said to a couple of people afterwards. People. Yeah. And that also, what a gift to be able to do that and have a practice of it and work out what's working. Like, that should just be, you know, speed pitching. If you can organize it within a writer's group or just with your mates, that is a really good way, a clever way of kind of doing it, or to be able to talk to booksellers or whatever about what your book is and just see what lands with them, see what is going to connect with them too. So
love that. And did you get to chat to the other authors also?
Yeah. So delightfully, there were two authors who traveled up from Melbourne on the same flight. Susan Patterson, whose new book, Where the Light Meets the Water, is out soon. And I get to launch it, which is exciting. And Anna Kate Blair, who's got a book called The Modern coming out at the end of the year. She's actually from, I know her through Writers Victoria. And she still is at Writers Victoria, but this is her debut. So that was really lovely to have kind of people to chat to. And I knew a couple of other people. Gorgeous Tegan Bennett Daylight was there, who you and I both know. And that was delightful. I heard, do you know Mark Dappin? Have you read Mark Dappin's stuff before? So his new book is called Carnage, nonfiction. It's about a prison escapee who like literally contacted him to say, write my story. He's still hiding from the cops. Anyway, crazy. So that was really interesting talking to him. Got to talk to Tracy Spicer.
That's not Shantaram like, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of a bit weird, but I was like asking him about the legal. I'm like, dude.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was all lovely. And of course, getting to meet Simon and Schuster, people who, some of them whom I never met before, and some who I had not seen since, you know, I flew up before The Motherfault came out and then never saw them in the flesh again because of what happened. Anyway, it was fun.
That's awesome. And was it a one day, like, did you fly up and back in the same day or did you get to stay in a hotel?
Got to stay in a hotel where I promptly then binged the first four episodes of Wellmania. Have you watched it yet?
No, I'm dying to watch it.
Oh my God, it is so good because then I binged the second four episodes the next night. It is
what is it?
So on? Good. It's on Netflix. It's like globally number seven or something. It is so good. It is so funny. It also made me cry. It's just, you got to watch it. We're not even going to talk about it now because I'm going to wait until you watch it for us to discuss. I do want to admit to both you and our listeners, failed to get the selfie with Lee.
Disappointing.
Yeah, we are standing next to each other in the group shot that the lovely photographer took. but, you know, she was in and out and there were a hell of a lot of people to talk to. So Lee and I, you know, we will next meet again, time. No doubt, and next time we'll work on our bestie status. But
I love that. You did actually get to catch up with the author of the book, Wellmania, while in Newcastle.
I did.
Before we get to that, start at the start. You are on the way to your festival. Having seen not even a lot of Twitter, I think you lost your luggage and your laptop.
Yeah. What's delightful is two different days. So I actually left the laptop in the bathroom on the way up to Sydney on the Wednesday. Didn't even realise. In the toilets at the airport near the gate.
Like in the hand washing area?
Yeah. Just like popped it there next to me. Delightfully for my kind of cortisol levels, I didn't realize that I'd done that until they called my name over the loudspeaker. And I'm like, you know, the first thing that flashed through my head was, oh my gosh, Simon and Schuster have upgraded me.
Oh no. You know, I would just be like,
straight
up. That's hilarious.
That was for about like 1 millisecond. And then the next millisecond, I was like, something terrible's happened to the kids. So I'm like hot footed to the woman and she's making an announcement. So I'm like just standing there looking at her. And then she's like, someone's handed your laptop in. And at that moment, I like look at my hands and realize I don't have the laptop. And I'm like, oh my God. So to whomever, the good Samaritan who handed in my laptop at Melbourne Airport, last week, to just a million thanks. So yeah, so that happened. And I was like, I've done all my travel karma is like, and then the next day I came home and then I flew out again and I decided foolish woman to check my luggage in because I had a couple of pairs of shoes and a whole lot of books and, you know, all the makeup. I was like, I'm just going to check it in this time. Arrive at Newcastle on a flight with like all the Melbourne authors who are arriving. So Jock Sarong's there, Sian Pryor's there, Robbie Arnott was on that flight. It obviously come from Tassie. Chris Flynn was on the flight. Geordie Williamson's on the flight. They're all waiting to get in the transport to the hotel. And I'm like, oh my God, it's so annoying because I'm the last person to pick up my bag. And then the thing shuts. And I'm like, it's just that, you know, like my bag's still out there. And then the lady's like, there's no more bags. I was like, but I'm going to a festival. Like, anyway. I won't go into all the details, except to suffice to say that partly because I was speaking to Bridget Delaney up first and I just read Reasons Not to Worry, all about stoicism and this idea of the control test, which is like something happens to you and you go, can I control this? How do I react to this situation? So once I'd talked to the lovely lady at Virgin, established that my bag was not in the airport, it was either in Melbourne or it could have flown somewhere else in the country, and that at the very earliest I would get it back in the morning, but I may not get it back at all this weekend or ever, that I had to kind of process. And our dear friend, Shay, friend of the podcast, was brilliant as I sent her a panicked message. And she said, do not panic, Milton Hall. This is what you need. Basically sent me a list. She said, like, go to Kmart, find the quickest place you need, you know, undies, a black shirt, like a black shirt dress if you can do it, get your socks, get your deodorant, get your makeup, like do not panic, you know, don't go crazy. Don't go out and buy like the fanciest dress you've ever seen. And I also messaged other friend of the podcast, Anna Downs, and Ashley Collagen Blunt, but she was already on her way because I knew Anna was coming up, driving up the next morning. And I was like, mate, I am in a situation. Have you got any frocks that might fit me? Oh, have you got like a hair straightener? Have you, you know, like my whole bag. And Anna, to her credit, was like, I have been waiting for this moment. This is my time to shine. I've got you, babe. And I can't, you have to go on my Instagram to see the reel.
This is because, giving me tears. How nice is that?
Yeah. So the next morning, so not only also am I getting messages from everyone, like Sian's checking to see if I want to borrow a dress. Jock's asking, you know, I can have one of his holy surfy t-shirts. Robbie's offered me his shirt. Random people on Twitter, Instagram, because I've said my bag's lost, are like, I'm in Newcastle. I can bring you things if you need. Like just, yeah, nearly made me cry. I do my like big W crazy ass shop. Like I'm so focused. I get my undies, like, you know, find the black dress that I'm going to wear that night, $5. Find my $5 bling earrings that were complimented all weekend. And then Anna calls at 8:30 the next morning. She's like, babe, I'm downstairs. Come down. And she has one of the luggage trolleys, because she's driven one of the luggage trolleys, with like 30 dresses hanging on it. And just like I almost wept with joy. We had so much fun. I had outfit changes like in the middle of the day because there were so many things to choose from. So it was an absolute delight. And then to finish the story, I got back to Melbourne Airport to pick up my bag and take it home with me.
Sad little bag.
My sad little bag who had lost apparently its baggage tag between when I put it in and when it followed down the thing. And
I'm glad you got it back because you have a special bag. I've seen this on our
runs. I do have a new special bag and I had a new dress. It like so many things. Anyway.
Brutal.
It really brought out the best in everyone, gave me a story to tell, you know, and I got to practice my newfound stoicism. So win-win.
When you said that you thought of Bridget Delaney, I didn't immediately think of stoicism. I thought, oh, yeah, she's someone who'd have lost a bag in her time.
Right?
Yeah.
And yet the thing, and so like to do some backstory on Bridget Delaney and I is that Bridget Delaney and I met in Ubud when I won a trip with Books and Publishing as a student. I think we got student logins or something.
I remember this. I was going to ask about this.
Yeah. And literally, and Skylarking was being published. I must have been in edits. And someone from Books and Publishing rang me and said, you've won a trip as a subscriber to Books and Publishing. You've won a trip to Ubud with The Guardian to do this masterclass with Bridget Delaney, and you've got a, well, you know, all access pass to Ubud. And I just, it was the most exciting thing that's ever happened in my life. I think it was more exciting than getting the publishing deal for Skylarking. Like, I was like, this is like, I am on the up. You know, things are really happening here. And it was the funniest experience. It was one of the women who was there with me, and I tried to write a play afterwards about it. And Bridget concurs. It was a very funny experience of like seven women who don't know each other. I wasn't allowed to say that I was there on a comp ticket. So, but, and I was the youngest except for Bridget by like 30 years. It was all very, you know, wealthy, older women who were writing their stories and wanted to swan around in Ubud. And it was just hilarious. People got sick.
I remember you
people
talking
got locked
about
out.
This at the time.
Like, it was crazy town. It was crazy town. And that's when I met Bridget. And so the idea, and then I followed her since, and the idea of her taking on this new kind of life of tranquility and moderation, just like, I wanted to say, mate, are you having us on like me? No one would call me tranquil or moderate.
I guess Bridget's other book, Wellmania, I mean, she's written a lot for newspapers and things as well, but Wellmania is the pursuit of wellness.
Yes.
By trying all of these wild and crazy wellness techniques. And so she's also hilariously funny and has mishaps along the way. So it does feel like.
Yeah, hilariously funny. And I think this idea of a testing or experimenting with an idea or, you know, that very journalistic style of going, okay, well, I'm going to throw myself all in and see how this works. The book's fantastic. Audience adored her. She sold so many books. It was a really wonderful conversation. So that was a hell of a lot of fun.
Do you know if she reads the audiobook? I could just look this up. That didn't come up.
I do not.
I listened to it on audiobook. It's good, but I just am curious as to whether or not it's her voice. Something I could Google very easily.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I know that Reasons Not to Worry, that this new one on stoicism has sold like in so many territories, which
I
is
think
really
because
interesting.
It comes with her voice too. Like
yeah.
she has
yeah,
this
yeah, yeah.
lovely way of explaining
yeah.
things. That's
yeah,
very
she was ace. Very fun.
So good. Now you have a newsletter
for
The Bowerbird, and your most recent issue for subscribers was all about festival etiquette.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you pick the eyes out of it? Give us a few freebie tips.
Yeah. Okay. I will. I'll pick the eyes out of it. And I will say this, and that what I said in there is I've like got radar eyes for newbies or people who may not be feeling comfortable at festivals. And partly I've got this because, and I say this in the newsletter of my very first festival experience, which we've talked about for lots of different reasons at different times at Byron Bay when Skylarking just came out, and I was sick to my stomach with anxiety. And Bryony Doyle, amazing author, Bryony Doyle, who's got a new book coming out soon, like just took me under her wing and went for walks with me. We wing-womaned each other. We went and had, I'll always remember, the most delightful jug of Bloody Marys before we came home. And she was just terrific. And from that, I have taken this idea that if you are in a position where you can introduce someone, give someone your number, say, hey, we're all meeting in the foyer. Do you want to come with us? Have you got somewhere to have dinner? All of the things. Do you need deodorant? Have you lost your bag? That's a really good way of doing things. So that's one of my principles, to try and like give someone a hand or extend that. Extend the kind of delightful warmth and generosity that's been extended to you in the past on. My other really big one, and it's incredibly important, and I would say this is the most important one, is to be an introducer when you can. And to ensure that whenever you introduce yourself, you introduce yourself by your full name. That's super, super important. And it, actually a publicist taught me that at Brisbane Writers Festival when I was like, oh, I'm just Kate. I'm just from Kate from Melbourne. And she was like, no, you say your full name. She said, you also say your book, but that can feel weird and awkward for you. But if I'm introducing someone to someone else, I say, this is blah, 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 blah. You might know their latest book, blah, 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 blah. It, like it just, it's so simple. People feel weird about it, but it's helpful. Like it's super helpful. One of the situations that I walked into that I, that is one of the ones that in my head I'm like regretting is that I didn't properly meet Andrew Quilty, who was there, the artist was there at the festival. He was introduced to me as Andrew. I didn't make the connection. I didn't get back to talk to him once I worked out who it was, you know, so it's just like, there's a lot of people, you're meeting a lot of people. There's a lot of things going on and it is our conference. It is our staff drinks. It is, I know people don't like the networking word and that's honestly, it's genuine delight. I do not see it as networking. I see it as festival drinks and having fun and catching up with people that I know or I want to know. But it is incredibly helpful to be a connector and a person who is saying this person, and it just, it's validating as well.
Well, I think also, you know, what your experience talks to, that first name, surname, book, you've heard of people, like you do know them, but you don't get it when it's just Andrew.
No, exactly.
As soon as it's, you know, got a bit more context, then you're like, oh.
And it's such delight because that's what, when you're doing it, mostly what you see is people go, oh my gosh, I loved your book, or, oh, wow, I didn't realize you were going to be here. And it's, it's a win. Yeah. You've just got to do that part. Got to do that part.
Super fun. Of course, I'm going to ask all the juicy questions off air. But for now, let's go to our featured book. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Alan and Unwin, and we're talking to Madeline Lucas about her debut novel, Thirst for Salt. Madeline Lucas is the author of Thirst for Salt and a senior editor of Noon. Born in 1990, she was raised in Melbourne and Sydney as the daughter of a visual artist and a rock and roll musician. In 2015, she moved to New York to complete her MFA in fiction at Columbia University, where she now teaches in the undergraduate and graduate writing programs. Her essays and interviews have appeared in publications such as Paris Review Daily, The Believer, Literary Hub, Catapult, The Lifted Brow and Meangen, and her fiction has been awarded the Elizabeth Jolly Prize and the Overland Victoria University Emerging Writers Prize. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and her dog, Pancho. Welcome, Madeline.
Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Now, Thirst for Salt, as mentioned, is your debut novel. Tell me, when did you know that you wanted to write this story and how did you begin?
It had a pretty long gestation. The seed of Thirst for Salt began almost a decade ago when I was finishing my creative writing undergraduate degree at the University of Technology in Sydney. And as part of my honours thesis, I wrote a short story about a young woman, her older boyfriend, and their dog. So those three characters were part of the book from the very beginning. And that story was set in a more ambiguous, remote coastal landscape that was inspired by isolated beach towns that I grew up visiting in New South Wales and Victoria. My parents separated when I was quite young, and they're both working artists, which meant we often spent time in these places in the off seasons when they were quieter and less expensive. And then after I moved to New York to do my master's at Columbia, I just kept finding myself drawn back to those people, their story and that landscape, which seemed to contain all of the things that I found myself missing most about Australia now that I was living away from it for the first time. So I do think of the novel in some ways as being driven or motivated by my own homesickness.
I love that. Sailor's Beach is a fictitious town that the book is set around. Am I right in thinking it's that particular Sailor's Beach is based on the Jervis Bay area on the New South Wales coast?
That's right. Yeah, it's inspired by the Jervis Bay area in New South Wales, which was a place that I grew up visiting on holidays with friends and family. And I actually found through some research, I think Sailor's Beach was the alternative name for one of the beaches around the Hinds Beach area, though not commonly used. So I plucked that from the Wikipedia and used it for the novel.
So interesting. you're probably not aware of this, my co-host Kate Mildenhall wrote a historical fiction book set in the same area, and it's about two young women who are friends. They're the daughters of lighthouse keepers, which is a story you mention in the book.
I do know about this novel, actually, because an early reader and editor who was interested in the book had also worked on that novel. So there was a bit of a serendipitous connection. But, you know, I understand being compelled by that story. It's a very dramatic story and was something that I kind of turned up in my research about that area as well, and was just fascinated by the story of these lighthouse keepers' daughters.
Yeah, it's incredible. Tell us the title of the book, Thirst for Salt. What does it mean to you?
So the title comes from a Robert Haas poem called Meditations at Lagunitas. And in the poem, he speaks a lot about desire and longing. Longing, we say, because desire is full of endless distances, is another line from the poem, a line that's written itself into my own heart at this point. And that idea really resonated with the themes that I was trying to convey in the novel. And the idea of salt was already all throughout the book. It's such a part of that coastal landscape, but it also has that association with the biblical figure of Lot's wife, the woman who famously turned to salt after looking back at what she'd left behind. Yeah. So I kind of liked all those resonances that were there. But I think to me, the idea of a thirst for salt speaks to a desire that can never really be satisfied and that might even do you harm, which seemed to capture something about the dynamic between my narrator and her boyfriend, Jude, who is 42 to her 24 when they meet on that kind of fateful summer sailor's beach.
Mm. The book could be described as a love story in some ways, but it's probably not the sort of love story that we're used to. Tell us a little about love and love stories. Do we inherit them from our parents?
That's a great question and something I was trying to grapple with a lot myself while I was writing the book. And I did really want to write a love story. I love love stories because I think that the love story can be this really great vessel to get at larger existential truths about longing, memory, loss, what gives our life meaning. I think love brings up all these really profound questions and is one of our most profound human experiences. But for all of those reasons, it was also really important to me that the novel contained other visions of love that weren't purely romantic. So there's the close but complicated bond the narrator has with her kind of youthful, impulsive mother, the almost maternal feeling she has towards her much younger half-brother, and also the love of a good dog, which in my life is the closest I feel like I've gotten to unconditional love. But I also just don't think you can talk about love without talking about family, which is really our first experience of intimacy. And, you know, for better or for worse, our parents are the first example we see of how to love and be loved in the world.
Mm. There's a real cyclical feel to the relationship that the protagonist's mother has had with her father, with the protagonist's father, and then this relationship that the protagonist has with a man called Jude. In what ways do you think there are similarities there, and do you see the differences that exist as well?
Yeah, it's a complicated question to answer without getting into too much nitty-gritty detail about the book or giving too much away. But I think that the narrator is very informed by the knowledge that she was born when her mother was the age she is, 24, when she meets Jude. And that raises the question in her mind of, will she also have a child at this time in her life? And I think that there can be both a fear and a compulsion to replicate the patterns that we've seen in our parents' relationships. So I think in a lot of ways, the narrator is someone that's grappling with that of like, will I inevitably make the same choices? And I think part of her journey, part of her coming of age in the book is realizing that she's capable of making different decisions to the ones her mother made.
Mm. You've made a conscious decision in the book not to name the narrator. Tell me what you thought about when you made that choice.
Honestly, I felt like I just never found a name that suited her. And although the novel is not autobiographical in any classic sense, I felt like I'd given her so many of my own thoughts and feelings that the only name that felt right would have been my own name, but that would have raised all sorts of unproductive questions that weren't really relevant to the book. But I do think of her in some ways of being maybe a different version of myself, or a version of myself in an alternative reality. And I also think there's kind of an exciting charge with anonymity. And the question of, you know, how much is truth, how much is fiction, is something literature has kind of played with and toyed with for centuries, you know, dating back to the kind of tradition of epistolary novels, which kind of have that sense of verisimilitude. Is this real? This is a real newspaper clipping. You know, I'm thinking of things like Dracula, you know, going way back. So I think that that kind of line of questioning can be exciting for a reader as well. At least I hope it is.
We've spoken a little bit about why you chose the Sailor's Beach setting, but how does this particular place shape or influence the characters and their relationships?
I think that sense of isolation is really important, that their relationship is taking place in this kind of cloistered or sheltered place. I think, you know, when the relationship is going well, it feels protected in a positive way. And when it's not, it maybe feels claustrophobic. But I think that so much tension in fiction is heightened when you trap two characters in a place where really they have to face each other. And I think that's, you know, part of that kind of more remote coastal landscape. The narrator is kind of separated from the rest of the world, or the person she is in Sydney, where she's been living. And I also think that anywhere in the Australian bush, there's always a sense of threat or risk or danger. And that had interesting tensions for me as well. You know, the small town, it's like one road in and out of town. It's vulnerable to fires. One of the narrator's first experiences there is getting stung by a bluebottle jellyfish. And so there are all these ways that I think that she can never really feel totally at home in that space, that it's always, yeah, a little bit dangerous or offers a little bit of risk to her too.
Mm, I love that. Madeline, we have a lot of listeners to the show that are writers. What is either the best or conversely the worst writing advice you've received?
Well, it's a cliche, but I'm a real believer in writing what you know, mainly because I think that we know so much more than we actually think we do. When I think of the advice to write what you know, I think that also encompasses dreams, memories, imagined experiences, as well as lived ones, the subconscious mind. These are all such an intimate part of who we are. And I don't think that writing needs to be autobiographical in any way, but I do feel that I myself am always more drawn to books where you sense that the writer has a strong personal connection to the material, that kind of sense of skin in the game.
Okay, next question. Can you recommend a debut book? It can be fiction, nonfiction, from any time, any place, any genre.
Yeah, it's such a tough question to pick just one. But to make things easy for myself, I will say that a book that really influenced Thirst for Salt was Marilyn Robinson's 1980 debut novel, Housekeeping. And I love that book. It also takes place in a fictional landscape that is based on a real place in Idaho, I believe. And it really influenced my thoughts about the way that family, transience, the kind of myths that we grow up with shape the way that someone inhabits the world. But I also loved the way it was described when it first came out. A critic said, "Here's a first novel that sounds as if the author has been treasuring it up her whole life, waiting for it to form itself." And I just thought that was such a beautiful description and what I aspired to create in my debut novel. I don't know if it'll feel like that to anyone else, but that idea really inspired me while I was working on the book to try and create something that would feel that way to a reader.
An incredible review to receive. Like,
such a I know. The review of dreams, you know, the review of a lifetime. We should all be so lucky.
That's right. Madeline, I know you're New York based, but you are coming to Australia. Do you have events here coming up? Where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, I'm so excited to be coming home in May for a bunch of different events in Melbourne and Sydney, as well as appearances at Bendigo Writers Festival and Brisbane Writers Festival. I'm also teaching a workshop as part of Brisbane Writers Festival on writing dynamic relationships, which I'm really looking forward to. So readers, oh, I guess listeners, can keep in touch with me on Twitter or through Instagram or on my website, madelinelucas.com.
Thank you, Madeline Lucas, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
We've talked a lot, Catherine, but tell us, what have you been reading, consuming, listening to?
Okay, I have two recommendations. One is an article that came out this week, which will feel a bit later than this week by the time this episode comes out. It is an article by the poet Maggie Smith in The Cut. Is this ringing any bells?
No, tell me.
It is an extract from her book, You Could Make This Beautiful. I'm just trying to find the name of the article. It's called My Marriage Was Never the Same After That, which is an excellent title. Maggie Smith is a poet. In 2016, she wrote a poem that went viral. What an incredible undertaking. Who has ever heard of a poet that's gone
amazing.
Viral?
How the good poems, was the poem? What was the poem?
The poem
about?
Was excellent. It's called Good Bones. I don't read a lot of poetry. I liked it. Feels very readable. But basically the article, and I think her book is about, so she writes this poem, it goes viral, and she has this experience of her home situation has been, her husband's been the primary breadwinner. He's a lawyer. He makes a fair amount of money and she's the stay at home and she does poetry sort of sporadically. Her star begins to rise and they initially have this conversation in bed that you can sort of get the sense that, oh, this isn't going to go very, very well. And so her star rises, her level of success grows and he's unable to deal with it. It's a very, very honest article. It is the kind of thing that is not uncomfortably honest, but is so honest that it's almost jolting within that extract.
Yeah, wow.
Setting. So it's obviously very critical of him being threatened by success, or that's kind of the theme that it talks to, which I think is a fascinating thing to discuss. Somewhat sad in some ways that is still a discussion.
Have you finished reading The Anniversary yet?
No,
Stephanie
I haven't
Bishop's
finished.
Anniversary.
Is that?
Well, I mean that is part of what's happening in the relationship, this jealousy of the rising star in the other person in the marriage.
Well,
keep going. I interrupt.
To me, I think what was so interesting about it is, like, it's a story you see on Real Housewives all the time. So there's different types of housewives, but there is this sort of coupling that exists, and you have this wealthy couple, very traditional structure of stay-at-home wife, mother, being in the background a bit, and then you have the wealthier man. They go on the show and suddenly the wife, the housewife, finds fame and fortune. And it's testing of a relationship, whether the male can be okay with that or whether, I mean, these are heterosexual relationships. But fascinating too, because it just feels like it's in the zeitgeist a bit. Reese Witherspoon announced her divorce recently, which then...
That.
Yeah.
It was almost a conscious uncoupling kind of a Instagram message, wasn't it?
I don't know how you get that Instagram message thing right. Like, it's an impossible, impossible
It totally
thing.
Is impossible.
But, that kind of Oscars curse, which I think has been verified by Harvard, when a woman wins an Oscar, her relationship falls apart within 3 months or something. Something terrible like that. But just, I feel like there was a lot of this same kind of thing. And this article is very, very beautifully, beautifully written.
I look forward to reading that.
Fascinating read. The other is, and this gives away our guest for next week, author Kevin Wilson.
Yes.
Who's an American author. I feel like for an Australian audience, I have to say this is not the Kevin Bloody Wilson of the 1990s. Do you understand that reference?
Yeah, totally. Do. And also to say this is, Kevin Wilson has been on your wish list. Like, this is a big coup.
It was so good. Like, just to get to talk to him, I was excited literally for, the interview has been in the pipeline for months. I've been excited for months. I had the interview organized. He ended up having a home disaster and had to cancel. And I wasn't sure if he would, because it was hard to get that time for the interview. So I wasn't sure if I had lost
And it was sort of taken from my hands moments before it was happening. It was like a half an hour before. Anyway, Kevin Wilson, if you've not heard of him, my whole recommendation is just read every single thing he's ever written.
Is there a place to start?
There is a place to start. So excellent. His debut novel, it's not his first book, but his debut novel is called The Family Fang. I hadn't actually read this. I'd read his later work. This book is so incredible. Who knew that it's also been made into a movie with Nicole Kidman?
What?
Yeah, God, exactly.
He's so famous.
He's so famous. So he's really interested in the making of art, and this Family Fang is about performance art. And it starts off, this is giving nothing away. The parents in the Fang family are very into performance art, and they like to watch what happens in the aftermath, and they get their kids really involved, and their kids hate it. So it starts with, very early on, this scene of a performance art piece they do where the whole family goes to a shopping centre and pretend not to know each other. And the mother is wearing this big, puffy coat. And so they go separately into this lolly shop. And the mother starts to steal lollies. And one of the kids goes over and tells the shop owner, oh, that woman's stealing lollies. And so she gets confronted by the sales assistant and asked to leave. And she does a very dramatic thing, saying, I have not stolen these lollies. And as she exits, she pops something on the coat, and like kilograms and kilograms of lollies just pop out of this coat. Oh, it is such a fun, weird, like in terms of weirdness, it reminds me of like Anne Casey Hardy, that Portion Retails for Excitable Girls.
Yeah.
Like beautifully weird, bit Paige Clark, She's Haunted, another great short stories. It's weird, but it's so tender and beautiful about weird. And I reckon start with The Family Fang. He's got multiple other novels and short story collections, but that one is particularly just lovely and wild and, yeah, a mind-blowing debut novel.
Oh, I'm so excited, both to read and then to listen to your interview.
So good. So good. Tell me, listening, reading, watching, what have you been doing?
Listening, it's been busy, but I did really want to mention that my gym buddy, who I Pilates and gym with in the morning, gave me a recommendation of Chrissy Swan on The Imperfects. So I sometimes listen to The Imperfects. I think we've recommended Esther Perel on The Imperfects before. But this Chrissy Swan episode on honesty, it's called, I think it's from a few episodes back. But I listened to it on the plane to Sydney. It's quite a long episode. It's over 2 hours. I think that the interview just kind of kept on going. And it's basically Chrissy saying, I came to a point in my life where I was like, stuff this. I'm not doing some of this shit anymore. I'm going to be radically honest with myself and my kids and the people around me, and say what it is that I want to do with my time and my energy. So for instance, one of the things that she does is that she says to the kids, I hate making school lunches. Like, there is nothing about making school lunches that gives me joy. And so she just sat down, ordered the same lunch for every day of the entire term, like dropped $750 doing it, which, you know, may be privilege, may also be, if you think about what you spend on the school lunches over an entire term, you probably come up about that, and just went, stuff it. That's what I'm doing. Like, I am taking this thing that I don't like off my plate, which was fantastic. And the other thing that really spoke to me, like, it's a great, I just really recommend listening to the whole interview. But the other thing that really spoke to me is that she said our house, obviously she's very, you know, high profile kind of a person. She has been in the limelight. It's 20 years since she was on Big Brother. So it's been a long time that she has dealt with fame, which she says she quite enjoys. But you know, that's part of her life now. But she said our house is a compound, and she meant compound in the way that once everyone's in, once the kids are in, her partner's in, you know, like this is where we are just us. Everything outside is a way you can walk around in the nude, eating your babies, whatever she says, you know, this is just our place. And I really love that idea. And I think it's partly because I'm feeling a little bit unskinned and raw about, you know, having a book out. This idea that there is a place where you just go, but in here, everything's just really bloody normal. Like, we are just normal family doing normal things, and there's it's kind of the outside world. So I really loved it. And it reminded me of that Sally Hepworth podcast that we talked about last year. I think it was on 40, where she talks about like her rules, like she doesn't go into the schoolyard.
Yeah.
That is her husband's role. He does those things. She just, she doesn't like it. And this idea, or Kate Kennedy talking about, you know, the things that she's saying no to, that she's realized at her age, she's now like, stuff this, all the stuff that I used to do because I thought I had to. And this idea of women mostly saying, nah, not for me. I'm not interested. I'm not doing that. So, yeah, highly recommend that. And I just wanted to mention these two beautiful picture books. Can I interrupt
just to ask?
Go.
Could you eat the same lunch for the whole year?
No, I couldn't.
Yeah.
My kids could.
Yeah, I could.
My kids could, for sure. You could.
Yeah. I think I ate the same lunch for 25 years. I ate the same meal, I would say 6 days a week for 25 years. And now the idea of eating it, I just can't do it.
What was the meal? What was the meal that you ate the same every day for 25 years, Catherine Collette? Reveal it immediately. Does it involve a can of tuna, beans? What is it?
No, it involves, I roasted pumpkin every day. I don't know why I'm laughing. Well, part of it, it got too much. I was eating way too much pumpkin. I started turning orange, which is a thing. But far more common a thing to be eating is carrots.
You started turning orange?
Like quite orange. But I didn't stop.
You're only telling me this now.
That's not what stopped me. I got sick of it. I didn't mind being orange.
After 25 years, you were suddenly like, pumpkin's not for me anymore.
Took a long time. Now I'm just not interested.
That blows my mind. Like you always do. You just come in just off the fly. You steal your brother's chocolate Easter eggs and you eat roast pumpkin every day.
I know. I need a new lunch though. So I would be happy with Chrissy Swan's approach.
That would work for me.
But I understand it would work for anyone. Two books. You've got two books.
I've got two books that I want to quickly mention, but now all I can think about is turning orange. The first one is this beautiful one. It's called The Garden at the End of the World. It's just come out. It's with UQP. It's written by Cassie Polamene and illustrated by Bryony Stewart. And the reason that I'm so excited about this book is that it is about the global seed vault in Svalbard, which I'm like totally obsessed with. And it is just, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. It's also, I haven't had time yet to go in and look how Bryony's done it, but it's like, it's like images of seedlings. Oh. They've been beautifully done. I don't know if they've been screen printed
or something.
It's just beautiful, but it's a very beautiful story, you know, a message about how we protect the future and ways of investing in the future. So very, very beautiful, Garden at the End of the World. And in a similar colour kind of scheme here, this utterly gorgeous one called Satin. It's written by Sophie Masson, very award-winning Australian writer, Sophie Masson, and illustrated by Lorena Carrington, who's an incredible artist. I think he's from Castlemaine. And she does their photographs, and then she does amazing things to the photographs. But it's about a bowerbird, or a kind of a magical bowerbird, and the collection of these items. But it is magnificent. It is such a beautiful, beautiful book. Text is beautiful. The idea of
so nice to give a nice anymore. Picture book, because it gets read and reread and reread and reread.
Read and reread, and they're just such beautiful things to have. So Satin and the Garden at the End of the World, I highly recommend. Satin is published by Midnight Sun Publishing. Have a look at them. They're very beautiful.
You have an event.
I have an event. I tell you what, I don't have. The postal van hasn't turned up in my driveway yet, but I do. I've got an event coming up. I'm running a free online workshop on the 27th of April with Manningham Library. We'll put the link in. It's on creative resilience. Goes for a couple of hours.
The one you have been running? You've done like a talk. The talk. This is different.
Yep. No, different. 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 This one is for writers at any stage, and it's looking at like the blockers, the things that block us from writing. So just getting started. How do we get started? Some strategies for getting words on the page. Various tips and tricks that I use to get things. So not so much publishing world, more like just getting the writing done. So anyone at any level, and then A couple of weeks later, very fun, I get the great honor of launching Claire Christian's new book, West Side Honey, which I've had a chance to read, and it is fun and sexy and romantic and delightful, and everyone should read it. And if you want a taste of the kind of stuff Claire Christian does, we had a fabulous chat last year, maybe it's in the archive, we'll put a link in, but she's just a delight. That's on Monday, May the 8th at Readings in Carlton.
Noni Blake, such a good book.
Recent one. Yeah. So very fun. It's in the vein of Noni Blake. People are going to love it.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.